Supporters of Iraqi Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr storm Baghdad's heavily fortified green zone and occupy parliament. Russia's energy giant Gazprom suspends its gas supplies to Latvia days after slashing deliveries to Germany amid tensions with the West. And the World Health Organization says it expects monkeypox-related deaths to increase as it calls for international efforts to contain the disease. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gizumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iraqi protesters storm parliament in the capital's highly security green zone for the second time in a week amid political deadlock over the formation of a new government. Demonstrators, mostly supporters of the cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, occupied the legislative body in the green zone, which houses various government and diplomatic buildings. Dozens of people have been injured and amid clashes with security forces. Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi has called on security officers to guarantee the safety of state institutions. Sadr supporters also breached Iraq's parliament building on Wednesday. The demonstrators are opposed to the nomination of former minister Muhammad Shia al-Sudani to replace Kadhimi. The bloc led by Sadr won most seats in the October 2021 parliamentary elections last month. The cleric, however, asked all of his MPs to resign after he failed to reach the two-third majority needed to pick a president to form a government. Moving on to the war in Ukraine, Kiev says Russia has launched fresh strikes on a number of Ukrainian cities. The Ukrainian authorities say two residential districts were targeted with rockets in the southern city of Mykolaiv. The mayor says one person was killed and six others injured in the overnight attack. To the northeast, the second school in Ukraine's second largest city, Kharkiv, was reportedly hit by S-300 missiles early on Saturday. Local authorities say the attack caused material damage but no casualties. The governor of the eastern region of Donetsk says the city of Slovyansk remains under Russian shelling too. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian presidency says its forces had carried out strikes on Russia's military warehouses and positions in the southern region of Kherson. The region which borders Moscow annexed Crimea fell to Russian forces only days after Russia launched its quote operation in Ukraine on February 24th. Russia's energy giant Gazprom has suspended gas supplies to Latvia amid tensions with the West over the war in Ukraine. Gazprom has cited violations of the conditions of purchase as the reason for the cutoff. On Friday, Latvia said that it will pay in euros rather than rubles when trading with Gazprom. Russia's company on Wednesday drastically cut gas deliveries to Germany via the Nord Stream pipeline to about 20% of its capacity. Tensions run high between Russia and other European countries over the Ukraine war. They have imposed sanctions on Russia targeting its economy. Moscow has labeled these countries as unfriendly, stating that they should buy Russian gas in rubles. Official data show that U.S. economy shrank for two quarters in a row. That signals the unofficial start of a recession there, an issue denied by President Joe Biden and White House officials. They cite positive effects, including a low unemployment rate, but that alone is not enough to push economic growth. The Federal Reserve has already raised interest rates four times this year to control inflation, which is at a 40-year high.
The U.S. economy has entered a recession. Based on the official definition of a recession, when the economy contracts for two consecutive quarters, that is the definition of a recession. Recession fears for the U.S. have been ongoing for some time. One of the factors which speeded up the decline of the economy was energy prices, which have affected the prices of goods, from food to basic stuff, leading to inflation. The U.S. is experiencing over 9% inflation, something it has not experienced in over four decades.
The American economy is being bashed from pillar to post right now by a whole range of factors, but certainly it's going into recession because there's severe headwinds being caused by, first of all, the government cutting back on its spending in a ridiculous attempt to balance its budget, which it should not be trying to do in the first place, and then high interest rates compared to what they have been in the recent past, even though they're below the rate of inflation, and meaning that households are no longer borrowing, and in fact they're probably paying their level of debt down.
The U.S. president has been trying to portray this as a temporary phase, which the U.S. economy will overcome.
We're not going to be in a recession, in my view. The employment rate is still one of the lowest we've had in history. It's in the 3.6 area. We still find ourselves with people investing. My hope is we go from this rapid growth to steady growth.
But as things are going, especially the war in Ukraine, this is anything but temporary. The mayor of New York has painted an even bleaker picture. He has said that we are in a financial crisis like you can never imagine. Wall Street is collapsing. We are in a recession.
President Biden has said the U.S. has avoided a recession, citing steady spending and measures to rein in inflation. But that now sounds like a broken record. Inflation has not tamed. Prices at the pump are lower only because the U.S. had to release more oil out of its emergency reserves. And it's quite hypocritical to say that spending is steady as the U.S. public debt is standing at over $30 trillion.
The poor state of the U.S. economy is typical to many economies around the world, especially the ones in Europe. One of the telltale signs is the price of energy, which has affected Europe so badly that economies in countries like Germany, the UK, France, and Italy are all experiencing GDP contractions or slow economic growth. The Ukraine conflict is definitely one factor weighing down on the economies, but it would be wrong to blame the negative economic performance just on the war itself.
No, I don't think the government's done a good job because all last year this began and they did nothing because they thought it was temporary. And, you know, during the pandemic, everybody got passed out money, including stores and all of that. And so it's like too much money floating around. They were very late to the game. And I don't think the administration's really put it as a very high priority.
Consumers are being bashed by inflation running about 5% per year higher than wage rises. Now, in that situation, consumers are likely to be trying to do everything they can not to spend.
The U.S., similar to Germany, is carrying a deficit. That is when companies import more and export less, dynamic that weighs down on the GDP. Yet the future looks bleak. As economies are still facing the COVID pandemic, with supply chains not fully recovered, the U.S. is pursuing an aggressive policy towards China, which involves a trade war. Europe is bound to follow the U.S. lead, which can only make matters worse for their economies.
And happening now, thousands of train drivers across Britain's railway network are walking off their jobs in protest against low wages amid soaring inflation in the United Kingdom. Roughly 5,000 drivers took part in the 24-hour strike. Nearly all services in Britain's 34 train operators were cancelled. Cancellations also took place in regional networks. The drivers are demanding higher pay. They say current salaries do not meet the country's rising cost of living. The strike is the second major industrial action this week after 40,000 other railway workers held a massive strike on Wednesday. Britons are dealing with skyrocketing living costs. Inflation has gone by past 9%, the highest rate in four decades. Sectors other than the railway have also been hit. That includes postal services, health, schools, and airports, among others. The Venezuelan government vows to challenge a London High Court ruling over the country's gold reserves. They are worth almost $2 billion and held in the Bank of England. The court has a rule that the control of the reserves should fall to the board of advisors named by Venezuela's opposition leader, Juan Guaido, not the one appointed by President Nicolas Maduro. After a four-day trial, the judge concluded that the British government recognizes Guaido as interim president of Venezuela. The dispute dates back to 2019, when Guaido, who then headed the National Assembly, swore himself in as interim leader following Maduro's re-election. Guaido sought control of Venezuela's Assets Board, a law firm representing Venezuela's central bank, has called this decision unfortunate and says that the bank is considering an appeal. Lambert Opec, a former UK Member of Parliament, joined us earlier with his take on the court ruling on Venezuela's gold reserves.
I think what we're seeing here is the mixing up of politics and the judiciary. I mean that the West has oftentimes used the legal system to promote its political agenda. It seems to me this has happened here again. And therefore, although you could argue that if the court says it's legal, then it is, I would strongly encourage the Venezuelan authorities to challenge this through appeal. Secondly, motive. What's the motive here? Well, the motive, I think, is the attempt to crush the existing Venezuelan government. And as you've pointed out, and as my colleague has pointed out, the democratically elected leadership of Maduro. You don't have to like a leader to respect democracy. But if you think about it the other way around, imagine if the Venezuelan government tried to bring down a British leader using financial sanctions because they did not like the British leader. I personally believe that this is an Anglo-American initiative primarily.
A survey released by the British advocacy group CAGE has revealed shocking feedback regarding British schools pushing Western propaganda on Ukraine while gauging any student activities in supporting Palestine. The findings appear to show UK government involvement with both initiatives to peddle Ukraine's sympathy and outlaw Palestinian solidarity. Robert Carter reports.
A new study has revealed a shocking disparity by British schools, which have gone to great lengths to promote Ukraine solidarity among their students, in stark contrast to how Palestinian solidarity is suppressed in the classroom. Human rights group CAGE carried out the survey, which received 532 responses from parents, students, and teachers. The group said the survey revealed a cavalier attitude to due diligence, including collaboration with organisations with far-right links and the soft penetration of security think tanks and those linked to the UK's so-called Prevent Counter-Extremism programme. Some of the survey's findings include 96% of respondents confirming proactive engagement on the Ukraine issue by their school, including holding non-uniform days, activities, or donation appeals. 62% indicated their school had fundraised or hosted donation drives for Ukraine, while 17% also mentioned schools promote the Ukraine flag, such as hoisting the Ukrainian flag on school grounds. And perhaps most shockingly, alleged funding from some schools was intended to provide military gear for the war. In 2021, Israel's bombing of Gaza drew huge international backlash as millions took to the streets worldwide. British students also joined the outpouring of support for Palestine. However, British schools responded negatively, with students being punished for waving a Palestinian flag or branded racist in some cases for expressing solidarity.
For Palestine, supporting Palestine goes against British foreign policy interests. Support for Ukraine is in line with that, and hence that was allowed and encouraged, and the government even produced guidance for schools into how, and for parents into how they could do so. While for Palestine, the government minister for education at the time, Gavin Williamson, he issued a letter, clear letter to schools, indicating to them that discussion on Palestine needs to be clamped down or managed to such a degree where it can only ever amplify the pro-Israeli, pro-apartheid narrative.
In early July, London's High Court dismissed a legal challenge by Cage against the Department for Education over issuing so-called discriminatory guidance, which was then used by schools to censor and penalise any student who was willing to express solidarity with Palestine, particularly during Israel's bombardment of Gaza last year. This whole saga will have convinced many more that Britain may indeed be biased when looking at conflicts and human rights abuses abroad. Robert Carter, London.
Last week, the head of the WHO called the monkeypox outbreak a global health emergency, saying that the outbreak represents a public health emergency of an international scale with the highest level of alert. Monkeypox has spread for decades in parts of Central and Western Africa. It primarily spreads through close physical contact and generally causes a mild disease. However, it can be fatal and can cause serious symptoms. More than 16,000 monkeypox cases from 75 countries have been reported to the WHO this year. Currently, only COVID-19 and polio are considered as global health emergencies. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. God says that if you are grateful, He will certainly give you more. In another, He says, "And if you are ungrateful, My chastisement is truly severe." Quran is full of divine traditions. I said this that from the beginning of the Qur'an to the end of the Qur'an, as you can see, the divine traditions are continuously being explained and repeated. They have been mentioned in different places in the Qur'an. Such has been the course of Allah, and that has indeed run before, and you shall not find a change in Allah's course. The Holy Qur'an, Surah 48, verse 23. There are four or five such cases where God says the divine traditions are immutable. This is because the divine laws are perfect laws. God is not family with anyone. To say that we are Muslims, we are Shia, and we are the Islamic Republic, so we can do whatever we want is not right. We are no different from anyone else. If we put ourselves in the situation of those first kind of traditions, the results will be that. If we put ourselves in the situation of the second kind of traditions, the results will be this. This is definite.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In the year 1981, in the face of all these events and all these severe attacks, we were able to stand on our own feet and frustrate the enemy. And we were able to do this today too. God, in the year 2022, is the same God he was in 1981. God is the same in different times of difficulty and at all times. And all the divine traditions remain in place. Let us try to put ourselves in the situation of the divine traditions for progress. God is the same in times of difficulty and at all times. Now, let's talk about the issues relating to the judiciary. Mr. Mohseni presented a good report. Let me mention some of these points that I wrote down. He told us in his report that this and that has been done. I would like to say this again. The judiciary is like the other executive branches. Because one of the fundamental pillars in the country is the judiciary. Not just in our own country, this is true everywhere. Your successes and failures are both doomed to the rulings of the divine traditions, and they affect the whole country.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
At least 37 African migrants died recently when some 2,000 migrants tried to cross the high wire fence separating Spain's Moroccan enclave of Melilla from the northern Moroccan border town of Nador. Moroccan security forces have been blamed for this tragic incident. An eyewitness to the killings speaks here of what transpired.
We went to the city next to Meia, and they beat us badly. They killed our friends and family. The Moroccan government said there were 23 dead, but we know there are more than 70. It's inhumane.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and it's always great welcoming you to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news making headlines in Africa. Now, this week's edition is focusing on the tragic death of over 37 African migrants who lost their lives in a crash trying to enter the Spanish enclave of Melilla in northern Morocco. We're asking, who is responsible for the deaths of these innocent African civilians? The second part of our program today will be on Somalia's catastrophic famine. Lives of millions, including vulnerable women and children, are at risk if urgent measures are not taken to mitigate the unfolding humanitarian crisis.
African migrants killed in Morocco. At least 37 African migrants were killed recently while trying to scale a fence to enter Melilla, Spain's enclave in Morocco. Melilla and Ceuta, Spain's other tiny North African enclave, have the European Union's only land borders with Africa, making them a favorite target for migrants. Moroccan officials who guard the checkpoint claimed many were killed in the crush, with others seriously injured falling from the fence. Shocking video published by the Moroccan Association for Human Rights shows police officers beating helpless wounded migrants.
The United Nations, the African Union, and independent rights groups have denounced the use of excessive force by Moroccan and Spanish security personnel. A senior Kenyan diplomat at the United Nations says the killing of African migrants in Morocco was a blatant violation of a UN Human Rights Council resolution.
Exactly 2 years ago, the Human Rights Council adopted the resolution on the promotion and protection of the human rights and fundamental freedoms of Africans and people of African descent against excessive use of force and other human rights violations by law enforcement officers. What happened to the migrants trying to enter the Spanish enclave of Melilla is a blatant violation of this resolution. Rather than being protected, they were assaulted. Tragically, this was not an isolated incident. It is part of a worrying trend in recent years in which people of African descent traveling to Europe via the Mediterranean suffer extreme violations of their human rights.
Well, for more analysis on the recent killing of innocent African migrants in Morocco, we have contacted Mustafa Traore, an academic, political analyst, and the founder of AnOpenEye.org. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time today.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Now, who is to blame for the latest tragic death of African migrants in Morocco?
Well, I think everyone is responsible for what happened. Poverty is one of the main reason why these people decided to go out from their countries, to leave their countries and try to have some kind of experience in the Western world. But what is the reason for the poverty they are going through back home? So this is a question I think we should ask ourselves. So I think many people, their governments, is responsible because it was not able to provide them with the jobs they needed just to live decently. Those causing the poverty, those who benefit from the poverty of the African continent are responsible. And of course, the authorities in Morocco, and I'm going to add Spain as well. So I think everyone is more or less responsible for what happened. The system has to change.
The United Nations has joined human rights groups in Morocco and Spain in calling for an independent investigation into the deaths of the 37 migrants.
We call on the two countries to ensure an effective and independent investigation is held as a first step towards establishing the circumstances of the deaths and injuries and any possible responsibilities, and to ensure that accountability is guaranteed as appropriate.
The state-backed National Human Rights Council of Morocco claims that Morocco says the African migrants who died in a mass attempt to enter the Spanish enclave of Melilla suffocated.
Human rights activists and campaigners say Morocco cannot be trusted with an independent probe as it is working at the behest of Spain to use every means possible to stop the migrants. A protester in Spain says such massacres are likely to be repeated in future. Now, can we trust the Moroccan probe that said that the migrants likely suffocated?
Of course not. They have to find an excuse. But at the same time, I think that even for Moroccans, life in Morocco is difficult. And I'm not sure that they have the kind of democracy we think of. So I do not have the people of Morocco have the respect of their authorities. So how come a system that does not respect its own people, how come is it going to respect people coming from other countries, and especially when these people have dark skin?
Africa is mostly viewed as a continent of mass migration and displacement caused by poverty, violent conflict, and environmental stress. This is while Western multinationals continue to plunder the continent's natural resources. For instance, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development says African economies are losing around $50 billion through illicit financial flows each year, with much of the damage rooted in trade misinvoicing of commodity exports. If such plundering by Western multinationals is halted, there will be no need for Africans to flee the continent.
The African continent is the richest continent on Earth. They have oil, they have gold, they have gas, they have all the resources, they have fruits, vegetables, everything can grow in the African continent. How come these people with the richest countries are leaving their homeland to try to have life or experience in the West? Well, I think this is what we have to target. When we study the system of all these countries, the agreements they have, and the policies that are put into place, the elections, we know that it is nothing else but corruption. So I think we have to fight against colonialism, corruption, and all these things, so that these people stay and remain in their back home.
The brutality meted out on African migrants has been condemned and termed by many activists as a pointer to double standards by Western countries, which have given preferential treatment to Ukrainian refugees.
The measures that can be taken are to open safe routes so that people want to ask for asylum can do so. This has been done for asylum seekers from other countries, from Ukraine. In 4 months, thousands of people have come to Spain. We do not understand why the same can be done for other countries.
Many migrants are leaving Africa to escape civil wars, violence, or persecution. There was an upsurge of violence and terrorism in Africa following the NATO-led military intervention in Libya in 2011. Now, this North African country lost control of a large part of the stockpiles it had amassed over 40 years. The transfer of weapons from Libya strengthened armed rebel movements across West Africa and Sahel countries that are now a major source of migrants to Europe. Now, what is the role of Western countries in igniting the current migrant crisis in Africa?
It is very simple. When you look at all these countries, these Africans are fleeing. None of them is a manufacturing country in terms of weapons. None of them manufacture weapons. So it tells us a lot. Who are those selling the weapons? Who are those creating chaos? Who are those, in fact, benefiting from all this situation? I'm going to take the case of Libya because we need very concrete examples. Libya, it used to be a peaceful land under Gaddafi. Now, what is the situation? Now, you have different groups fighting one another. And at the same time, you have some countries exploiting the oil.
The over-reliance on external aid in many African countries has resulted in many leaders neglecting their responsibility to serve their communities by failing to create environments that allow their people to thrive. This neglect has allowed Western powers continue looting the continent's resources.
And now my last question. What can African countries do to stop this migrant crisis?
Well, I think the best example today is what is happening in Mali. So we need leaders who are aware of the situation. And this goes through Pan-Africanism. For the first time, since a long time ago, We have in the African continent a government, the Malian government, the army, trying to put into place a system of Pan-Africanism. And we see all the trouble, all the things, all the stabbing that many countries are trying to do.
Well, our guest there says that the only way for African countries to develop is by ending the plundering of the continent by Western powers. I'd like to thank our guest, Mr. Mustafa Traore, for his insight. We'll now take a short break before our next topic, which is on Somalia's catastrophic famine. Stay with us.
Somalia's catastrophic famine. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The worst famine in decades is ravaging the Horn of Africa region, destroying crops and driving the cost of food out of reach of many.
In Somalia alone, 7 million people out of a total population of 16 million could be at risk of famine in the next 2 months if aid is not scaled up to meet skyrocketing needs. As Somalia enters its fifth consecutive season without enough rain, aid agencies are calling on world nations to take action and save lives.
A UNICEF official says Somalia and other countries in the region are suffering the brunt of climate change created by industrialized countries.
The Horn of Africa has extremely arid spots where communities struggle to survive. The situation is worsening, and children and their families are being worn down year after year with no time for recovery between climate shocks. The unfairness of it all is that these countries are least responsible for creating climate change, and they're bearing the heaviest brunt. Somalia, for example, is responsible for only 0.01% of the world's carbon dioxide emissions, but it's ranked as the fourth worst affected country in UNICEF's Global Children Climate Risk Index. I've been to Somalia recently and saw very closely the devastation caused by drought. In many parts of the country, no water, no livelihoods, only despair. I heard of children being buried along the roads as their families make desperate long treks to seek help. And we fear the worst is just around the corner.
To discuss the unfolding famine situation in Somalia, we contacted Tunde Osazua, a member of the Africa team at the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the famine in Somalia was predictable. So why is the world letting people die in this forsaken Horn of Africa country?
Yeah, it was very predictable. And Somalia faces the worst food crisis in the world. But the response to this catastrophe that was really created by the West has been to cut economic aid to Somalia, to carry out drone bombings in the country, and more recently, to return 500 U.S. troops to Somalia, which really represents another effort on the part of the U.S. and the West to deny agency and independence to the Somali people. Really, since 1991, the U.S.-led West has kept Somalia destabilized and really in a perpetual state of civil war, which has resulted in a million deaths. And the West's goal is to make the country an ungovernable killing ground where Somalis can't use their own resources, whether that be oil or uranium, to develop their country or deal with famine or droughts or other environmental crises on a national level.
Somalia has one of the highest numbers of internally displaced persons in the world, estimated at 2.9 million people in 2022, of whom 2.2 million require urgent humanitarian assistance. One of the displaced persons speaks here on the dire situation.
The situation around here is extremely difficult. People are hungry and in poor health. People don't even have shelter. Every time a car passes here, people think that somebody is coming to give them food.
When Western governments pledge aid money, it is rarely handed directly over to poor countries such as Somalia, despite the rhetoric about how much money is given each year. Pablo Yanguas, the author of Why We Lie About Aid, Development and the Messy Politics of Change, says many Western aid agencies actually lie about the aid they give to poor countries.
We lie about aid because it's very hard not to lie about aid, because the politics in donor countries have become so vicious against the aid sector, and the demands on transparency and accountability have become so onerous that the only way that the aid sector can survive is by fudging the reality about what they do. And that is essentially why we lie about aid.
Somalia is a classic case of how humanitarian assistance is used to perpetuate neo-colonialism. Dozens of Western humanitarian agencies have been operating in Somalia for decades, yet there is no end in sight to the suffering of Somalis.
Yeah, so the U.S. led West, under the cover of humanitarianism, intervened in Somalia in a number of instances to advance the interests of oil companies, of multinational energy corporations. As the top World Bank petroleum engineer remarked at the time of some of those interventions, Somali oil had high potential, and it provided that Somali citizens could get their act together, they could really deal with a lot of issues they're facing, but that hasn't played out due to the influence, really, of some of these international actors. And the 500 U.S. troops that were sent to Somalia in May are a more recent attempt to violate the sovereignty of that country and to prevent any robust response to the crises that they're facing.
Somali legislators elected former leader Hassan Sheikh Mohamud as the country's president following a long overdue election in the troubled Horn of Africa nation. Now, he used his inauguration speech to appeal to the diaspora and international community to help stave off famine that threatens this drought-stricken country. He also noted that one of the main challenges the country faces is insecurity, which has also impacted negatively on food production.
East African countries are facing security challenges from terror groups such as Al-Shabaab and Daesh. So it is necessary for us to continue working together closely to repel those enemies and save our people.
Now, can the current government in Somalia handle the famine situation?
The West doesn't want a viable central power or government in Somalia. The Western interest in blocking that development is that Somalia is known to sit on, you know, massive deposits of minerals, including oil and uranium. So the U.S.-led West has fomented the disintegration of the Somali state and society over the past three decades, since, you know, 1991 and the 1992 U.S. invasion, because to create a legal and political landscape where oil companies can profit, the perpetually weak and unpopular Somali government has had to fight to really extend its reach beyond, you know, the capital city of Mogadishu in order to secure control of you know, territories, you know, that are were formerly in control of militants like al-Shabaab. And so in this fight, the Somali government and its allies, including the U.S. And even countries like Ethiopia, have really brutalized the Somali public. And so, you know, to think of them even having a robust or a real response to the famine is kind of out of the question. They can't really effectively handle it.
Aid agencies say while resilience-building efforts across the region have made important progress, the frequency and severity of droughts in recent years, combined with the exceptionally prolonged nature of the 2021 to 2022 droughts, have made it harder and harder for families to recover between shocks. Michael Dunford, World Food Program's Regional Director for East Africa, gives a brief assessment of the situation.
We are now estimating that 81 million people across Eastern Africa and the Horn are food insecure. This is a 60% increase since June 2021.
Now, what should be done for this perennial famine problem to end in Somalia and indeed across Africa to make the continent resilient and self-sufficient in food production?
Yeah, the solution to this famine crisis is to return agency to the Somali people and to remove Western influence, you know, corporations and troops from the country so that people-centered, participatory, democratic processes can be fostered on a grassroots level from the bottom up, right? So that, you know, they can work to achieve those adequate levels of food production and resilience. Really what we've seen is that the U.S.-led West imperial plan for Somalia has been a failure, right? Like, you know, the U.S. has been unable to control or fully control the country's oil, despite the, you know, many number of invasions and incursions it's unleashed in the country. So the real solution here is to, you know, fight for the self-determination of the Somali people so that they can solve these issues because, you know, the West has been unable to do so.
Well, there you have it. Famine in Somalia can only end if the country attains full self-determination. Thanks a lot, Tunde Osazua of the Black Alliance for Peace, for your insight today. And that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you watch the show. Thanks a lot and goodbye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone. Dear sisters and brothers, welcome to IRB English Radio. This is Q&A on Islamic belief, where we shed lights on your main questions. I'm Asma, your host for today's episode. It's the time of Muharram, so I hereby offer my condolences to all the lovers of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. Here with me, I have a brother, Nur Muhammad, a scholar of religious studies. Assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for coming. Well, since it is Muharram and we have this time of sorrow that will sit in everyone's heart. All of us would feel such a deep pain as our leader and as our beloved one, Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, has been taking in all those terribles and sorrows and pains. So we feel that mourning all the time. There is no doubt that crying while mourning for Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam has got so much of blessings attached to it. And a drop of tear on mentioning the sorrows he went through can move a mountain of sins and turn it into dust. Now, apart from real weeping and crying, we have learned that even pretending to be mourning or crying is going to be rewarded, and we actually have been recommended to at least pretend mourning for the sorrows of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, which is called tabaki in Arabic. Now, here's a question. Isn't it a form of disrespect to just pretend?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, talking about the tabaki, I'm going to elaborate on this issue. But before that, let me add one point about the, you know, shedding tears for the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein and his companions. We have, as you mentioned, lots of narrations in this about this issue. And of course, the philosophy of that is very clear. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted to keep alive the message of Karbala through these tears. And he wanted to keep the message of fighting against the oppression and tyranny alive for and to keep it forever. And because of that, and through this crying for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, it remained. Of course, this is one of the philosophies of that. And it would remain forever till the day of judgment, and the message of Hussein is alive. And of course, we cannot tolerate and stand any injustice and oppression worldwide. So we have a lot of narrations and about, you know, from Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam about this issue. Let me share one of them. We have that Imam As-Sadiq told Abu Harun, "Anshidni fil Hussein." Imam As-Sadiq told him that improvise poetry about Hussein. And he said that, "Fa'anshadtuhu fabaka." I made the poetry about Imam al-Hussein, and he cried. And then he said that, "Man anshad fil Hussein shi'ran fa'abka wahidan falahu al-jannah." If you improvise poetry about Hussein and to make other people to cry and to shed tears for him, your paradise is for you. وَمَنْ أَنْشَدَ فِي الْحُسَيْنِ شَعْرًا فَبَكَى فَلَهُ الْجَنَّةِ. And if yourself cry for the martyrdom of Hussein, paradise is again for you. And he said, وَمَنْ أَنْشَدَ فِي الْحُسَيْنِ شَعْرًا فَتَبَاكَى. We are talking about the tabaki. If you make a poetry about Imam al-Hussein and to make yourself crying for him, paradise is for you. So the meaning of tabaki is sometimes we do not feel crying. Okay. Yeah. So we are not in mood of crying. But if you some kind of, let's say, to some extent, make yourself cry, okay, this is a meaning of tabaki.
Or at least have a gesture of mourning.
Maybe we cannot say gesture or pretending. This is not a meaning of tabaki. Tabaki means that you, to some extent, to, let's say, focus on the, and to remember the story of Karbala and the events of Karbala and make yourself cry, even if you do not feel it, okay? Because in other narration that even to the amount of the wing of fly, if you cry, Okay, you are not in a feel, you are not in a mood of that. But if you try your best and to focus about the story of Karbala and to cry even in that minute amount, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give you the rewards of the mourners for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam. This is a meaning of tabaki. So it has nothing to do with pretending or the gesture of that. Maybe some other scholars, they interpreted the tabaki in this way, but according to some other scholars who are expert in understanding the meaning of ahadith and the, you know, some other specific word with regard to the narration, they have interpreted this tabaki in this meaning that I describe for you.
Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
You know what I mean? When you go to a ceremony in which it has been held for martyrs or a funeral, even if you don't feel like crying, you have to show that mourning upon the expressions of your face. So in that, I actually meant this. I actually meant it in this way, that when you are, the meaning of tabaki is that when you are not even feeling like you wish to cry, or you're not in the mood to cry, you have to give that impression that you are mourning for that person.
Maybe the idea that you mentioned is very close to the exact meaning of that. Let me share the translation of that. Mm-hmm. What is the meaning of tabaki? حَمْلُ النَّفْسِ عَلَى الْبُكَاءِ وَالسَّعِي فِي تَحْسِيلِهِ. Try your best and to kind of impose yourself to cry and to concentrate about the event of Karbala and try to cry for the mourning of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam.
Mm-hmm.
So it has nothing to do with, for example, the gesture of that or to falsely, pretend that you are crying for Imam al-Hussein. It should be, kind of a reality and your real sentiment. You have to show it for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam. And what matters here is to remember always the tragedy of Karbala. Try to have further study about that. And by even, remembering the story of Karbala and thinking about what happened to the Imam al-Hussein and his companion, automatically and naturally, human being crying.
Yes, exactly.
This is, if you have imagine the concept of the, standing against oppression and to sacrificing whatever you have for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and for, safeguarding the religion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the meaning of sacrificing whatever you have in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I believe that nature of human being, whether you are, Muslim or non-Muslim, any religion or atheist, if they can imagine what happened in the, story of Karbala, they naturally weep for the martyrdom of the, doyen of martyrs.
And by the way, his love has been buried in our hearts. So every time we come close to Muharram or even in the other month of the year, when we remember his name, it's like something is burning inside our chest. And no matter we are in the mood for it or not, we feel that sorrow and that mourning in ourselves.
Exactly. What you mentioned is a narration from Noble Prophet Muhammad. إِنَّ فِي قَتْلِ الْحُسَيْنِ حَرَارَةٌ فِي قُلُوبِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ. Surely for the martyrdom of Hussein is a kind of, passion in the heart of human being.
Mm-hmm.
and in the heart of the faithful people. So it is a reality. And what I want to mention that, and I would like to ask my dear listeners to go and have further study about the event of Karbala. You know, this is not the story of Karbala and the event of Hussein is not limited to only Muslim.
Yeah.
It is, you know, relevance to human being. It is relevance to freedom.
Yes.
You know, justice seeking.
All those people who believe in freedom and who believe in justice, if they come across the story of Ashura, they would feel so attracted to it.
Yeah, it is a